You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole, the 602 Club, where podcasting is our birthright. And I am just one of the hosts, Matthew Rushing. I'm so excited to be joined once again by the one and only Scott McCullen. Scott, man, how are you doing?
Hunt him down.
Oh, wow. Hopefully that's not me. Aimed at me.
Oh, it's you. It's you.
Again? Dang it. I thought nobody would notice. Well, we're excited tonight because we are going to be diving into another brand new film here that was just released in the theaters, The Running Man, based off a Stephen King novel. And of course, previously a movie starring none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger. But before we dive into any of that, you can find us all over the internet. We're on social media under the 602 Club. You can also find us at the entire network at Trek FM. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. And we're online at Trek.fm, where you can see all of the shows we're doing. We're on Instagram at Trek FM. And as well, we would love it if you would give us a star rating review over on Apple Podcasts. That would be fantastic. We would love the help there. It's been a while. And it also helps other people when they're searching for podcasts find the show. The more reviews you have and the better the reviews, the more your podcast gets recommended to people. So help us out that way. And you can go over to Patreon at patreon.com/TrekFM, become part of the team, make sure that all that we're doing here on the network can keep coming to you each and every week. But so I wanted to ask you this, Scott, because obviously this being a film that has a previous iteration with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and of course being based off a Stephen King book, do you have any history with either of those?
If history means the past month, then yes.
I think it counts.
Okay. So to answer your question, because with The Long Walk and The Running Man, I thought it was crazy that within 2 months there were going to be two Bachman books being turned into movies and released in theaters, you know, in such close proximity to each other. So I did for The Running Man like I did with The Long Walk, and like 2 weeks prior to the movie coming out, I started reading the book because it's not a long book. Even with the audiobook, it's only like 6 hours. And so I did read it, and I finished it either Sunday night or Monday morning before the movie was released, before I was going to see the movie on Thursday night. And then Wednesday night, before going to see the movie on Thursday, I watched the Arnold movie for the first time because it was streaming on Paramount Plus.
Nice.
So that's my very, very, you know, condensed history with The Running Man, except for the fact that it's just a title that has like floated in the ether around me for decades. Like, I knew there was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie called The Running Man. I knew that it was based on a Stephen King book. I think at some point I got The Running Man and The Long Walk mixed up in my head because, well, running, walking, they sounded very similar in
right.
my head.
Yes. Yeah.
So so that's my history. That's, you know, so I've read the book and I've seen the Arnold movie, but they all happened within like a week before this movie came out.
Yeah. This is one of those things where, you know, I did not see the Arnold movie and I meant to get a chance to watch it before this came out and I just did not have time. And then I have not read the Stephen King book and did not get a chance to do that. A lot of times I will try to do those things beforehand because it would have been really interesting. I know that the Arnold movie isn't very faithful to the book for the most part.
Oh, no. I think that's an understatement. I think to say the Arnold movie is loosely adapted or not very faithful, that's like they took the title and a couple character names and the concept of there's a game show.
And that's it.
And then that's it. There is nothing recognizable between the Arnold movie and
they did that a lot. I feel like in the 80s, early 90s, where they would just take these books and the titles that people were kind of familiar with, and then turn them into a film that really doesn't have much to do with the source material. And of course, you know, the age that we live in is one where people tend to want to be closer to the source material. And, you know, we also live in an age where some creators will say they want to be close to the source material. And then you read the source material and you watch whatever it is and you're like, I don't think those words mean what you think they mean.
You keep using that word. I don't think it means exactly what you think it means.
And so... But yeah, so coming into this one, just with your quick experience of getting familiar with the original book and then the previous adaptation, how were you then feeling coming into this one? Was this a movie that you had circled on your calendar after you know, you'd seen the previews, you thought this was amazing, like, or was this just one like, oh, this one looks like it could be good?
This was a circle the date on the calendar kind of movie for me. The trailers really grabbed my attention, and I'm an Edgar Wright fan. Now, I haven't watched everything Edgar Wright has done is to basically say I've missed one movie, and every other Edgar Wright movie I have seen, and I enjoy his work. So it was just kind of one of those things where the trailers looked really good. It was based on a Stephen King novel, and it's an Edgar Wright movie. So those forces combined made it a, oh, when's this coming out? You know, it's the ones where, like, I'm checking my AMC app, you know, every few days going, Are advanced tickets on sale yet? Where are the showtimes? And like, we're like, you're trying to organize your life so that you can go catch, you know, in my case, like, when's the IMAX screenings? Am I going to be able to make that work with my schedule? Can I see the first one? You know, those kind of things. So that was my experience going in. So I was keen on this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a bunch of Edgar Wright's films, and I generally like his work and interested in what he's going to do. So the thought process to me of knowing that he was going to adapt this, you know, that it comes from a Stephen King novel, the fact that they were going to be closer to the book and, you know, try and give us something that, again, just... We're not going to just take names only, you know, we're actually going to try and make this a pretty close adaptation. All of that was exciting to me. And I think, too, you know, I'm not afraid to admit that the other draw for this film is you know, Glenn Powell. And
oh, he's just charming as heck.
Yeah. You know, the meteoric rise that he's had in film here meant that this was one that I was then looking forward to seeing. And I will say, too, the promotion for this film did a really good job of also selling those things. And so, and, you know, I didn't think this was going to be like, you know, Baby Driver or something where it feels almost like a musical with the way the movie is put together or anything. But I was just really interested to see what they would do with this. And this is something I wasn't quite expecting, though, honestly, is that really this movie was going to come down to being more of, and there's a lot of action, there's a lot of stuff going on, but it really did feel like that this was a movie that was a lot about message, right? Like, the movie's message here was really trying to, I think, speak to our current climate. And, you know, before we even just dive into all of the particulars of that, was that something that also surprised you about this, of not just trying to be like an action movie, but actually be a movie that you felt like, oh, they're trying to say something here?
Well, that's interesting because since I had read the book, the message in the movie is the message in the book. Like, yeah. So I guess in my mind, because I had pre-gamed and prepped for it, the movie didn't surprise me with that, because it was kind of like, well, if you're going to tell me this is a faithful adaptation of the book and I've read the book, well, this is what's there. Now, the funny thing is how the messaging in the movie feels so topical, yet it's based on a book that was published in 1982. And the quirky thing is, the book, the events of the book, published in 1982, was set in 2025.
That is interesting.
So that was a fun part of that. And another thing to remember when I'm just thinking about the weird, like, prescience of the subject matter is it's a Bachman book. So a lot of the Bachman books were Stephen King wrote early on and only published them later. Like, The Long Walk was actually the first book he wrote. Carrie was the first book that was published, but he wrote The Long Walk first, but only published it years later under the Bachman name. So I don't know exactly when The Running Man was written, air quotes. I can only say that it was published in 1982. But yet, like you said, the topics felt so just spot on for our day. And as I've said before on other outlets that I've appeared on, I mean, this is why I love science fiction. This is why I love speculative fiction. Someone writes something 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and yet you read it or watch it today and go, well, crap, that's a little scary. You know, it's kind of like, did we not listen to the warnings? Did we not read the tea leaves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's kind of come true.
It is really interesting for me in this because, you know, not having read the book and of course, with the Arnold movie, not really having anything to do with the source material, you know, the whole fact of this movie portraying a, you know, dystopian United States where the government's in bed with the media and massive corporations to rule over people. And then using the network, you know, to control information, you know, and to basically be the propaganda machine on how people will see the world, what they'll believe and why they'll believe it. You know, that part doesn't really seem that far out of the realm of possibility, especially with the world
realm of possibility. You mean like what we live in right now?
Yeah. For the last, you know, but this is something that's been happening for a long time. But like you said, I mean, this is something that if you look back at fiction, you know, you think of 1984, Strange New World, Brave New World, sorry, Strange New Worlds is Star Trek, but Brave New World and something like Fahrenheit 451, right? And a lot of the ideas that he's kind of playing with here feel like they could fit in with any of those other created works, right? And things that where it's almost like he had pulled together a lot of those ideas and then kind of created his own thing. But
well, there's also the movie, I think about the movie Network. Like, that's not even science fiction, but the commentary about what the media does and how the media manipulates stories for the sake of the audience. That was the entire point of Network. And I can't think about that because the Criterion just announced that they're releasing that in February. So it's all kind of it's all kind of bubbling to the surface right now.
Yeah, you did kind of expect somebody to be in this film. I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And
I think Ben Richards was mad as hell. I was not going to take it anymore.
Well, and what's – I think the thing that is just so interesting about this is, like, when you see the way in which absolute greed has just kind of taken over this society, and – in the end, corporations want to be able to control people, you know, down to the minutia of their lives, in the sense that they want people to function as cogs in their wheel, and they don't want people like Richards, who has compassion for other people, who's willing to help other people, because what they want people to is to be stuck in these, you know, tribalistic society bubbles, so that if you're in a certain stratosphere, there's no real movement, right? If you're rich, you're rich. You're poor, you're poor. If you're blacklisted, you're blacklisted. Like, people don't have the ability. There is no there's no forgiveness really anymore in this society. It's truly become a transactional society. Like, kindness has given way to people and everything just being treated as commodities. You know,
well, it also kind of reminds me of something that I heard today from the writer Walter Kern, who said about today's society that they, being the powers that be, the corporations, they want to make us miserable so they can sell us happiness. They want to steal our happiness so they can sell us happiness.
Well, and I think in that, it's like you want to sell your version of happiness, right?
Right.
And I think – so it's fascinating watching this, because I was reading a book and there was a quote in there that was utilized, and – it goes, philosopher Zena Hintz used the term "the world" in quotes to refer to the prevailing culture. She wrote, "The world is governed by ambition, competition, and idle thrill seeking. It is a marketplace where everything can be bought and sold. Human beings are primarily vehicles to achieve the ends of others." And that just stood out to me, because I was like, I'm reading this book and I go see this movie, and that is legitimately what this society has done to people, right? That everybody has just become a vehicle to achieve the ends of another person, right? And in that sense, there is this mechanized version of society where at the top, right, everybody at the top uses the people at the bottom as cogs in a wheel to continue the society flowing the way they want it to flow. And, you know, I think that there's really something to that. And the scary part of that to me, though, is that the show itself, the Running Man show, you know, its whole idea is to really control the categories in which people see one another. But those categories are controlled narratively by the network, right? We create these, and the network itself, it's not just the Running Man show, but it's just the network itself, this you know, in Fahrenheit 451, it's the wall, right? The entertainment wall. And this is just utilized, you know, to control the way people think and the way people act. And they are really incentivized to not actually think for themselves, which I find to be incredibly fascinating. And, you know, so Amelia being the test case in this, who's never met a blacklisted person. She's never met a poor person, really. She doesn't have any interactions with these people. Her only conception of these people is what she's been told, right, on the network, which we've seen over and over again, the way they portray these people, the way they basically make up lies about these people to further their ends on the network. And I thought that, again, this, the way that this movie was discussing all that was really, really interesting. And I think that the movie is really unsettling in that, because a lot of what's being said we are seeing in our own society.
Absolutely, because it's about narratives. It's like, I construct a narrative because this is what I need you to think. This is what I need you to believe. These are the perceptions that I want you to have of these individuals, because you thinking this way about these people, air quotes, propagates my goals. Because it's all about control. It's all about keeping people in their place.
Yeah.
I mean, there is so much class society, class divide messaging in this movie. There's a lot to be said about haves and have-nots, and how do the haves keep having, and how do the have-nots keep not having it.
Right.
And this movie does is different from the book, kind of. Like, the book will talk about basically their ability to use like Photoshop to alter people's perceptions visually, because once again, going back to your Fahrenheit 451 reference, like, that's kind of the whole point about what Ray Bradbury was trying to say, is the book censorship, the book burning, wasn't because the government came down and said, no, you can't read anymore. It's because the people gave it up and said, we don't want to be uncomfortable. We don't want to be presented with ideas that could make us feel icky. Could you just make these pesky little books go away so that we can just, you know, watch our wall-sized televisions and, you know, pop our designer drugs and be happy?
Well, I think it's really interesting to me, because the whole thought process of the way in which we control people is through anger, right? We get people angry. And the most interesting thing about that is that if, you know, anybody I think that can think for more than 5 seconds that's not angry realizes that anger creates in us the inability to think clearly. And that's exactly what, you know, the network in this film wants. It wants people to be in a constant state of anger and frustration so that it can control the narrative more easily, because nobody actually asks any questions, right? Because when we're angry, there's so much going on in our bodies chemically that doesn't allow us to think rationally.
Well, look at social media. That's why negative posts get more engagement. So do accounts try to do? They try to either fictionally or hyperbolically, they try to post things that are going to tick people off.
Yeah.
Because then people have to jump in for one reason or another, because I mean, it's kind of like the old newspaper adage, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. You know, it was interesting kind of watching this film, because it was one of those things where I can really see, you know, where Collins got a lot of her inspiration for the Hunger Games, watching this and knowing that this was pulled from Stephen King. And the other part of this that I actually found really interesting was that the quote-unquote YouTube truthers are the ones that seem to be the only ones telling the actual truth in this world. You know, you have the truth teller, the apostle, who's basically doing not quite a YouTube podcast, because YouTube doesn't exist. You know, they have VHSs that are getting passed around, you know. But
they're doing breakdown videos. Like,
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Now, that was new. That's original. That's original to the movie. That is
okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
That was not in the book. That was not in the Arnold film. So that was that was an addition made for the film, but I'm going to say I really liked it because I liked the flavor that it added. That, but you're right. It felt like I felt like I was watching a YouTuber, you know.
Well, and the fascinating thing about that is that that whole sphere of influence has been something that has dramatically shifted the media landscape in the world that we live in and has disrupted kind of the monolithic media. And in that, you know, a lot of people have been very glad that that's happened. But there are also a lot of people who have not been very glad that that's happened. And in many ways, people have blamed it for being the thing that has made it harder to understand, okay, who do I trust? Who would I believe? You know, and yet I thought it was fascinating that this idea of the alternative media of the apostle, you know, or somebody like Elton Paracus, you know, Michael Cera's character, right? You know, who's doing his you know, crazy newsletters. We look at history, right? And even just thinking about the way in which alternative media publications, you know, say in like the 70s, you know, like a National Review or something like that. They got started because they were alternative programming, basically, to what was seen as a monolithic media. And so this was something I just didn't expect because, you know, whatever side of the aisle you're on politically, you'll probably read this movie one way or the other. And yet I felt like that the film made it more difficult to just be like, oh, this is completely one way this way, and this is film is completely the other way that, you know, like it added enough things from our world that feel very real to a lot of people and a lot of different sides that it wasn't just all or nothing one way or the other.
Well, I think, and that's always the part that gets me is that what I think the movie shows, and it tends to be intellectually where I stand, is that these political divides that you alluded to, a lot of times are artificial manufacturing of these powers that realize that if we're too busy arguing and bickering with each other, then they can just laugh their butts to the bank and keep on doing what they're doing because we're too busy yelling and screaming at each other. And we're not looking at, you know, kind of like what the movie says, which is don't look at the shows. Don't look at, you know, don't look at the network. Look at who's getting paid. You know, it's the old, you know, follow the money, you know, kind of trick. And I feel like that what you're saying is that you'll, depending on which side of the aisle you stand on, you know, you'll read this movie differently. But I think the point is that, well, because the point it's making is that those divides don't matter because we're all getting played. And I think we could all, we might disagree on who's playing us. But I think that's the point. Well, we're all getting played, and they don't care about those little divides anymore.
Yeah, I do think that there's a lot of truth to that, and the whole idea of what people in control at the top really want is, like you said, they want everybody at each other's throats because it doesn't allow us to actually focus or work on any of the problems, because then that changes the dynamic, and that's bad for those who are truly in control. And so I did find that to be a really interesting part of this movie. And again, it's just one of those things. And I think, again, I think I said this earlier, but it is kind of one of the things that coming out of the film, it was very disconcerting of a movie to watch in that sense. because it's is so in your face. And I think too, and before we get to the other things, because I think that we're already on this thought process, but the solution for the film is a little bit different than the book, which is, you know, the I read that the book has Ben crashing the plane into the building with Killian in it.
Yes.
Whereas, of course, in the movie, they have him escaping the plane and leading
the
a revolution.
Movie, they actually suggest that crashing the plane into the building is the network's narrative.
Exactly.
That they want Ben to do, which I thought was fun when I was like, oh, yeah. Okay, you're acknowledging that that's like the plot, but yet you're making it the plot.
Yes. And so I thought, you know, that was interesting, but I think one of the things for me that actually made this kind of difficult to deal with, and part of it I think is because of the reality of the world in which we live, is that I'm becoming more and more wary of things that portray massive acts of violence as the way in which to enact change, because I think that just continues to go with the anger narrative that they want from us. And the problem is that, again, anger needs to be tempered with a lot of other emotions and thought processes before it boils over. And so I think one of the things that I found about this movie was that the end basically really legitimizing this idea of violently taking over in this way reinforced some of like the worst things I actually see in our society that I don't really like. And really kind of bother me. And so again, this is one of those things where I think this movie is kind of, it feels sometimes, I think, almost too real in that sense. And in that, I found myself thinking like, oh, this is good. This is interesting. But I don't know if I'm necessarily really enjoying the process of watching this movie because of, you know, what it's bringing up or reminding me of, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. I don't know. I think the movie portrayed a situation where, honestly, revolution was kind of like inevitable. I mean, if you look at history, revolutions happen. They're not pleasant. You know, sometimes they turn out terribly. Sometimes they turn out okay. It's just you had to go through that hardship to get there. I'm not saying that it's convenient, and I'm not saying that quote, violence. I think the funny thing is for me is that I'm not going to say violence is the answer. I'm also not going to say violence isn't the answer. Because sometimes, yeah, you got to punch the bully in the nose. But I get where you're coming from. I am not minimizing your feelings or your thought process. I'm just saying, yeah, but look at the structure that they're in. Is it really going to go down any other way?
Well, and I think one of the things that's interesting, too, is that, you know, like you mentioned, we have absolutely seen revolutions happen at many different times and many different places, you know, but I think, you know, we think of some of the most famous revolutions in history, you know, the juxtaposition between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. The difference there is not just the idea that both peoples that get involved in these things are frustrated and angry, but that one is driven almost solely by anger and therefore turns into just a cluster. And the other is actually driven somewhat by anger, but more by principle. And that makes all the difference. And that's the thing, I think, to me, that's really just makes this such an interesting thought process. Because, you know, as I watch this movie, I'm thinking, oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, you know, there's a... there is a reason for these people to, you know, want this to happen. But at the same time, how they're going about it and the reasons that they're doing it are driven purely out of emotion instead of also reason. And that's a dangerous place to be, because what happens after the emotion is the most important part. And so I think that's the thing that really makes me, you know, think in this film. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting because obviously for most of this, what we've been talking about for this movie is the stuff that it makes us think about. And, you know, I think that's a hallmark of a well-done film to make you think this much. And that's great. I mean, I love that. And so I did want to ask you, because we mentioned this kind of up front, and we're going to circle back around to it now, because I think it's important. This is, you know, a Glenn Powell-led film, and both of us mentioned that, you know, we basically, that was one of the draws for this movie. And so how do you think he did as the lead of this film? Did he carry it in the way that you felt like he needed to? And, you know, is he cementing himself here with this role as a full-fledged movie star?
I think so. I enjoy Glenn Powell in this movie. I've heard some reactions that surprised me, is that they were like, well, his character was so angry. And, you know, it was like, well, yeah, life sucks. That's going to make you angry. And like that's kind of the point, is that he's a character who's flawed. He has this temper. The temper is what gets him into trouble. You know, maybe it's different if you go with the book ending where he dies at the end, you know, crashing the plane into the network building. So you feel like that there's consequences. That makes him a little bit more of a tragic figure with that ending, because his choices and his attitude ultimately leads him victorious, but bittersweet victorious. So, but I just think Glenn Powell, even playing this character who has anger issues, and like the scene in the beginning where he's like, you know, where that supervisor's like, did you bring your kid here to, you know, to guilt trip? And he's like, no, I brought her here so I don't smash your face into your desk.
Yeah.
I think he is. Glenn Powell has that ability to be equal parts asshole and charming. And I think that's intriguing, because, you know, you go from his character in Top Gun Maverick, where he's the jerk. Like his whole point is to be the guy you don't like. But then to go to movies like, you know, Anyone But You or Hitman, where you're just rooting for him the entire time. I feel like he's doing the job. I think he pulls off this movie. Because another thing about this movie is that it's about Ben Richards. Another criticism I've heard other people say is that, well, you really don't see the other contestants. You really don't get a lot of anything else. I'm like, well, no, because it's Ben's story. And the book is like that, too. Like, it's focused on Ben the entire time. So I feel like Glenn Powell carries that movie.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You know, I think he does a really good job with the role. I think he carries the film very well. I will say that for me, this has nothing to do with him. This is actually a thing I think that the movie doesn't quite do as well as it should, which is that I think the movie actually needed a little bit more setup with him, so that as he's going through this process, you know, the time with his family is so truncated that I think it actually does not allow him to fully dig into the emotional range that you would want him to be able to have. And I think that's just a failing of the movie in that sense of like the screenplay of not allowing there to be more moments that he has to play with, because you've gotten to experience along with him as the character these moments that lead to connecting with him and his humanity. That's not him. That's the film not allowing those things to be there, because the screenplay just doesn't really have that stuff in there. Again, I mean, the time from the beginning of the movie, I feel like, to the moment where he goes to tryout in the network is maybe 10 minutes at most. It's probably less. It's probably more like 7. And it does just feel like you would want some more moments in there to grab, you know, to key into his emotional core, because of, and the experiences he's been through. And this is where I think this is the thing too, on top of that. And again, this is not him, but it's like, we get these little snippets about the things that got him blacklisted. But I almost feel like the movie needed an open that was a montage of all the firings he had gotten and for why, and then let us in to, you know, his kid is sick and, you know, he can't get a job and those kind of things. I think that would have been a more successful way to allow us to do that without actually having to spend tons more screen time. But the emotional payoff, I think, would have been huge.
It's interesting. And I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm just going to say that the funny thing is that they give you more in this movie than you get in the book. Like, that's so...
See, that doesn't surprise me, because I've never... I mean, the few things I've read by Stephen King, his gift is not character development in that sense.
Well, I think it depends on what the book is. I think, once again, also the difference is this is a Bachman book, and the Bachman books are written in a much more... They were all paperback originals, so they tend to be a little bit more leaner. They tend to be a little bit more to the point than, say, like a proper Stephen King book is. Because, you know, you read something like The Shining, and, you know, the development of Jack in that book as the book goes on. Yeah, he doesn't front load it with you at the beginning. It's kind of like what he slowly peels away as the story goes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But because actually in the book, he only gets fired from one job. Like, it's one job that caused it.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the, you know, it's that whole, they even changed the name of the company. But yeah, there's like this one job that's like screwed him over, because it was like the company, like it's like the one big company to work for like blue collar workers. I like your idea, but I will say that I enjoyed what the film does, which is during the tryouts for The Running Man, how it used things he did at his previous jobs to justify how he's able to do the things that get him into The Running Man. It's like, yeah, he doesn't, yeah, yeah, magically have these skills. It's like, oh no, he's done this and he's done this and he's done this, which is what's allowed him to do these things, which, like I said, not the book. So at least the screenplay gave us that. And then later on in the movie, there's that scene of dialogue where he talks about, yeah, I got fired because of that, because this is how they painted what, right, I did.
Yep. Yep.
So I think it's there. I just don't think it's very, I don't think it's just very in your face.
It's definitely never the main focus.
No, really. It is not.
That's for sure. Yeah.
The beginning of the movie does move quickly. But I guess Edgar Wright movies tend to have a snappier pace anyway. So I wasn't surprised by that in the film. So it's kind of one of those things that's like, that didn't occur to me while I was watching the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can see what you're saying and go, yeah, that's an idea. Like, that was a path you could have taken.
I wanted to ask you, too, because obviously there's a bunch of other people in this movie. We'll talk about just kind of the villains themselves. But, you know, Michael Cera, Amelia Jones, William H. Macy, Katie O'Brien. And so was there anybody else here just because, like you mentioned, this movie really is about Ben Richards. Glenn Powell is the main focus. Every other character is there really just to support him and what's going on with him. And so was there anybody else that was able to stand out in the minor roles that they had?
In my opinion, and I think it's just funny because it's taking the villains, I want to put the villains kind of in their own category. I want to talk about like the allies he gets.
Agreed.
Throughout the movie. For me, it was Michael Cera. Which is funny because my favorite Edgar Wright movie is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So having Michael Cera there, because that character, what I appreciated a lot, and I know I'm doing a lot of referring back to the book, but I feel like this is what you do when you have adaptations.
Yeah, it's great.
That chunk, that second act of the book is an extremely weak part of the book. It's not very action packed. It just feels like a bridge to get you to the plane sequence at the end in the book. So what I love about Michael Cera is that he really between the screenplay and Michael Cera's performance, they really imbue that character, and turn it into something which it's not in the book. So I, from my perspective, going from the source material to the movie, they made that character something. They made that into a sequence. At his, you know, everything that happens at Michael Cera's house, like that's almost completely invented by the movie to give the to keep the action and the pace going, and to actually make it part of the story in a way, because the idea of this underground revolutionary resistance is not in the book. That's really an invention of the movie. There's more of the environmental concerns in the book, you know, like with the black family in Boston who has the 6-year-old with lung cancer. Like that tends to be a little bit of what the middle of the book talks about, which is, you know, there's that, and then that's where you really bring in the fact that Ben Richards' job, the whole idea was that all the guys are getting radiation and getting sterilized, you know. And so the idea of Michael Cera's character being more of like an actual, like, conspiracy nut revolutionary, I thought was intriguing and gave that character and that portion of the film a lot more gusto than the source material had. So that's why Michael Cera stood out to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I thought he was good. You know, I think he definitely added something to that role. And I think one of the things about most of the characters that he runs into, and I think specifically Michael Cera, Amelia Jones, and William H. Macy become the ones, you know, other than the family, who helps him out to really have moments to stand out. But to me, William H. Macy's character of Molly was the one who was able to really do something with the very minimal screen time that he had. And there was that really interesting moment where he talks about this idea of, I was going to bring you on as a partner. I wanted to tell you myself, but, you know, you beat me to the punch by, you know, instead of joining the Running Man. And there's just what's fascinating, I thought, about his character is there is somebody who has kind of spent his whole life subtly in the resistance, right? And yet he's not, you know, kind of crazy and over the top like the Michael Cera character. He feels very real in that. I just really appreciated his performance. I thought Amelia Jones did a great job. That's another place where I feel like there needed to be some more time between them for her to kind of really make that change. I would have liked just a couple of more moments, because I really did like the, you know, that moment as she's staring at the picture and looking then at Ben and realizing, oh, this is a real person, you know. I think there could have been some more moments there to help that. But on a whole, I think everybody does a pretty good job with the screen time that they're given. And on the other side, I mean, gosh, the people who are on the villainous side of this, Josh Brolin, Lee Pace, and Colman Domingo, I mean, look, they are playing this at like a 12, and they're perfect at it. Like, every single one of those guys just nails it. You want to hate these guys. You kind of love hating these guys throughout the movie. And I think that's one of the things that makes for a good villain. You know, especially the whole story we get with Evan about him being the original contestant who had lasted 29 days. And then he takes the deal, and his, you know, his wife and kids still end up dead anyway. And so he has just nothing really to live for other than just being alive, you know? I thought every single one of those guys just did a great job, and they were kind of joys to have on screen, actually.
Yes, all of them. And when I, going back to my idea about the source material, is all of those characters, the more interesting, nuanced elements of them is something that the screenplay adds. You know, McCone, who Lee Pace plays, you don't get that backstory. He's just a hunter. You know, he's just a boogeyman who doesn't even show up until the end of the book. Like, the fact that McCone's there the entire time throughout the movie is an adaptation issue where they added him back in, where he wasn't that figure that was there. And then Bobby T, you know, Colman Domingo's character, him being a little bit more nuanced as the host, like, he has like one or two scenes in the book. And what, because something that I love what the movie does is that you never forget about the show. The book forgets about the show for a chunk of the time, but the way they keep on cutting back to the running man, and you've got Bobby T there, you know, doing his thing, made the character more interesting and improved the story, in my opinion. Now, Josh Brolin as Killian is just a jackwheel and does it so well. So, which I felt was kind of funny, because the last scene of the movie, because it's a different ending from the book, felt like an homage to the Arnold movie, because in the Arnold movie, Killian is the executive producer and the host, because he was played by Richard Dawson. So having him take the mic and actually try to go out and like talk to the crowd felt like this was Edgar Wright's little, you know, wink to how things were done in the Arnold movie.
What did you think of just the action of the film, since so much of this movie is based around the action of the Running Man show? How did they do?
I thought they did good. I mean, the one thing I wish they would have done more of, because I remember this scene from the trailer, and then it happens in the movie, but it felt so quick, is because you've got those cool floating cameras that are filming him, I would have loved for there to have been more use of that really kinetic, dynamic camera work to film the action. And I feel like you didn't get as much of that as I would have hoped. Like, you get that one cool shot where the thing comes in through the window and Ben starts running down the hallway at the YMCA, you know, where he's like dodging all the bullets, and then he like slides into the elevator. Like, that was a really cool shot from the trailer. And I feel like that, I wish the action in the movie used a little bit more dynamicism like that shot does throughout. Other than that, though, because there's more action in the movie than there was in the book, The other thing was cool was that whole sequence where he's trying to get out of Boston and Ben's in the trunk of the car, and the entire action sequence is being shot from his perspective in the trunk of the car. I thought that was fun. So I feel like when Edgar Wright kind of did more of his thing, where it was a little bit more quirky and dynamic, it was better. And I would have liked to have seen more of that, which I know is a criticism that some people who do not enjoy the film have leveled at it because they felt like it was missing more Edgar Wrightisms than they would have wanted. And at that point, I thought the action was good. I just wish when you get those little brief glimpses of, oh, okay, that's cool, that's creative, that's quirky, I could have used more of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the action of the movie is pretty good. I do think it was interesting that there were scenes, obviously, that the trailer had in them, and it was a little bit disappointing in that sense, just because I was like, oh, I know how this is going to play out. And instead of kind of being surprised, and that's just something that so many movies do. They give away their best action beats a lot of times in a trailer. And, you know, so that the trailer had shown that whole scene of him, you know, running down the hallway and sliding in and then, you know, having the grenade and all that. I mean, all that was an entire sequence that I already saw. And so that's not a knock against the movie itself. That's a knock against the fact
that the marketing department,
yes, they tend to just give away too much stuff. And so, but no, I think the action in this movie is all really well done. There's nothing about it that, you know, in a movie like this, there's going to be moments of like CGI and all that kind of stuff, but all of this felt very real and kinetic and well shot, you know? So I was never thinking to myself, oh, that feels fake or that doesn't feel real or, you know, any of that stuff. So that's excellent. And that's what you want in a movie like this. And so I thought they did a good job on that.
And Glenn Powell did a lot of his own stunts for this film. So that also helps a lot.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Did you hear the story that he actually talked to a sprinting coach for this movie to make sure he would actually look good running on screen?
Nice. You know, did he not want to look like Tom Cruise when he runs?
Actually, no. That was the difference. They said the sprint coach said Tom Cruise is the only guy who actually knows how to run on screen. Like,
that's hilarious.
The sprinting coach is like, oh no, most people, if you watch them, they look awful and stupid because that's not how people run. He said Tom Cruise gets it. So
that's great.
So the sprinting coach actually said, yeah, you want to run like Tom, maybe not like in Tom Cruise's style, but he said, but Tom Cruise is kind of like your aspiration of this is how you look like somebody who knows that he knows how to run.
That's great. That's funny. I'm very interested to see where you're going to land for your ratings with this, because, you know, we've been talking through this and I feel like, you know, we've had a lot of really good things to say. We've had a few little criticisms. And so where are you ratings wise with The Running Man?
I land at 4 out of 5 billion new dollars.
Oh, wow.
I was
that's this a lot was, of billions.
Well, I mean, inflation, you know, it sucks. You know, a new dollar just doesn't go as far as it used to anymore. But I really enjoyed this movie. I think that it's not quite as Edgar Wright-y as I would like. I will admit this is so anathema of usually how I feel, but I missed the needle drops that usually Edgar Wright puts in his movies. You know, he's one of those directors, like you talk about Baby Driver, like where he's playing the music while they're filming, because in Baby Driver, the movie is cut and the action was choreographed to specific songs. Like, it was kind of weird to watch a movie that was just really just had a traditional score and really didn't have like fun music to play with it, I guess, because also it was set in the future. So maybe you don't want to have like contemporary or, you know, what would have been old songs in a dystopian society. But that was the one thing that was just like, oh, it's missing just a little something for me. But the humor worked for me. That's a criticism I've heard for some people, is that the jokes didn't land for them. Humor worked for me. I took my dad. My dad decided like 15 minutes before I left, I asked him, because I was like, hey, the seat next to me is free. And he was like, sure. My dad enjoyed it. My dad hadn't read the book. My dad hadn't seen the Arnold movie. He is very not easy to please when it comes to humor. And he was laughing during the movie. He was smiling. He was having a good time. We were chuckling about it when it was over with. So, you know, in my rating system, a 4 out of 5 means I had a good time. You know, I always have to tell people, like, 1's a dumpster fire. 2 is not for me. 3 was it was okay. 4 means I had a good time. And 5 means I think it's a masterpiece. So, you know, this was a good time. This is a movie that I will watch again. And I said this on another stream I was on. The book is a book I don't plan on reading again. The Arnold movie is a movie I don't plan on watching again. But I would watch this version, this Edgar Wright 2 in 25 film. This has got rewatch value for me. This is fun for me. Like, I enjoyed this movie, and so I recommend it. It's a good time at the movies.
Nice. For me, I think this is probably a 3.5 out of 5. And this is one of those things too that's really interesting, because, you know, sometimes you think, oh, a movie could possibly go up if I rewatch it. I don't know if the movie would ever go up for me. I think it's probably stuck where it is for me here. And I think part of that is that, you know, one of the things that I had while watching the film was just kind of like just being a little disconcerted, as I already mentioned. And part of that is some of the places where I think this really hits close to home. I also think that, you know, it's sometimes in that place where you're watching a film, whatever, and they're talking about really important issues. And then one of the issues is that they don't actually really have any great solutions for the problem. And so it just kind of leaves you feeling like, yes, I know that quote unquote the good guys won in this film, but there's also a part of you that doesn't really feel like almost anybody won, you know, at the end of this in some ways. And so, but I think it's a well-made film. I really like what you said though, and I think you're right on target with this. When I go in to watch an Edgar Wright movie, I actually do kind of expect there to be a film that feels very much like him. And this is one of those movies where I think you nailed it. It doesn't actually feel like him as much as some of his other work does. And in that, I think it's maybe missing something to where you're like, oh, I kind of wish you had gone in and inserted a little bit more of your own style to this, the style that, you know, we all know and love from you. It's one of the reasons that we watch your films. And so, but yeah, I still think that this is a 3.5 out of 5 for me. And I'll be interested to see, you know, how the movie does as we move on into the holiday season, because it's also a film that's not like doing gangbusters.
It's actually delivering below projections.
Yeah. So
it's an R-rated movie. That's already kind of a, which is funny. I didn't go into it thinking it was an R-rated movie. And then, you know, after a few F-bombs, I went, oh, it must be rated R. But it's just suffering from a PG-13 versus R-rated, you know, kind of thing. I also wonder how many people, because I think there's a lot of people also who don't even know about the book, and all they know is the Arnold movie, and because they are two wildly different films, I don't think some people quite knew what they were getting into when, you know, when they talk about, hey, we're making a more faithful adaptation of Stephen King's book, and it's like, yeah, I don't think you realized how way off the Arnold movie was. So I don't know. And November's also been incredibly stacked. My letterbox is going nuts right now with all the movies I've been watching because, like, 3 movies this weekend, 5 movies this other weekend. Like, it's just I'm having to negotiate my life to watch all the movies that are coming out in November.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of stuff coming out. And, you know, like we mentioned, you know, the holiday season is about to hit. You know, you got big films that are going to come out, like the next Avatar film and things like that as well. And so, you know, part of this, too, is that I think, and we don't need to make a whole subject of this, but I do think Hollywood needs to find a way to start maybe making less and think about really investing in quality for films. And because there's just so much, like you were saying, there's so much stuff that's coming out and it can be hard to figure out what you want to watch. And then, you know, people are like, yeah, I got thousands of things to watch on streaming at home. So, you know, you got to make things that people actually want to go to the theater to see. And if you don't do that, you know, people are like, yeah, whatever. I'll just stay home and, you know, I'll watch Friends for the 457th time. So, you know, but if people wanted to catch up with you and see what else is going on with you, Scott, what you're seeing in a theater, what you're recommending, what's going on in life, where would they find you?
Well, you can find me on X at ScottDC27, on Vero at Scott McClellan, and on Letterboxd, Scott McClellan at ScottDC27. I always say the both of them because I have no idea like which one you would actually use to search me up on Letterboxd.
Yeah.
But I'm there. And then, so just do that. You know, I've got this coming weekend. I haven't watched the first Wicked movie, so I'm catching the double feature of both Wicked films back to back so I can just get the entire story. Plus, Rental Family with Brendan Fraser is coming out. So I want to catch that. And so, you know, if you want to see that or any of the other 5 movies I saw last weekend, you know, you can catch me on all my social medias and my Letterboxd account and read my reviews. But then, of course, every Wednesday night at now 9 p.m. Central, we moved an hour earlier than we've been doing. 9 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Pacific over at the Film Junkie YouTube channel. I'm still the co-host of the DC Fan Animated Stream as we endeavor to watch every episode of the DC Animated Universe. A really cool thing for the next couple of weeks leading up to Thanksgiving, we've been on a long Batman Beyond run. But we are about to tackle the 2-part series finale of Superman the Animated Series. It's been a hot minute since we've talked Superman, but we got some Dark Side, we got some New Gods, we've got the last 2 episodes of Superman coming up. So if you want to join us for watching how that classic DC Animated Series ended, check out the DC Fan Animated Stream.
Well, you could find me all over the place under social media under the name MattRushing02. So if I'm on that platform, that's where you'll find me. Of course, here on the network, you'll find me outside the 602 Club with Chris Jones talking a lot of Star Trek talk. We've got lots of great shows there. We hope you'll check all of those out. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is called Owl Post, which is a completed show. It is with Drea Kaufman. We talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, and it's a real blast, so I hope you'll check that out. And, of course, you can also find me doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now. You're here. Thank you.